Welcome to the Gottesdienst crowd, where we foster confessional integrity, liturgical preservation, and preaching that doesn't stink. We believe that the historic liturgy of the divine service is more than mere cobwebs of antiquity, but it is a true treasure of the church to be dusted off and brought down from her attic to be enjoyed. So let's get dusting. Welcome back to the Gottesdienst crowd. This is Jason Broughton. Today we have back with us Dave Peterson. Welcome back, Dave.
Thank you.
Today we are not taking up a gospel reading from a particular Sunday. Today we are going to be looking at putting together your own preaching protocol. And we're going to lay out probably pretty much what Peterson does, and I'll add on to anything that I do either differently or in addition to. But the point here is not to do exactly what we do, but rather to create your own plan and perhaps even the days upon which you're going to do these things. We all know that things don't happen unless they're planned out. So going in with a plan is sometimes just half the battle. So let's just launch in to see what you have and what kind of protocol you follow.
Sure. I mean, I'd like to, well, let's start first of all with why I think you actually need a protocol or a method or a plan. I think that what gets in the way is that we have sometimes this kind of false idea that we're going to wait for inspiration, or that because what we're engaged in is a divine activity, we're not in control of it. And mm-hmm. I mean, in some sense, we're not. But at the other end, we are 100% in control of it, and we need to just do it. I just listened to a podcast coincidentally on The Art of Manliness about the mundanity of excellence. Did you happen to catch that?
I did not.
I wasn't taking notes. You know, I was at the gym. But this guy studied elite Olympic swimmers and how they got to be so good. And a lot of it is that they just love swimming. So being at practice isn't a chore for them in the same way that it is for others. And then they focus on the actual details and pay attention to them. Mm-hmm. And there's a total method. So he talks about these other coaches. There was I know nothing about elite swimmers, but there was some great coach at Mission Viejo in California. And these other coaches then would try to come and see what he did, and they would leave bored because they would just be doing the simplest tasks over and over and over again for days. Mm-hmm. And anyway, he talked about this thing that you need to actually do it. So we should love actually sermon prep, and we should love delivering sermons, but I think the prep ought to be even better in terms mm-hmm. of the joy that it gives and it creates. I can understand that, you know, some weeks it maybe just feels like drudgery, but it is possible for pastors to just lose their faith and just go through the motions. We know that happens.
Sure.
But the way that their faith is going to come back is by actually paying attention to the scriptures. So anyway, you need to have this. We need to recognize that writing a sermon is a job. It's just work, and we ought to just come at it like that.
So to add something to that, I think, I don't know about you, but I find that most people actually enjoy the reading, the preparation. They don't enjoy the putting it all together and trying to perhaps not boil it down, but to try to find one single point to really kind of ram home, so to speak.
I think it's a single task.
Gotcha.
So, because if we're reading actively, if we're actually engaging with the reading, asking questions while we're reading, praying while we're reading, responding to what we're reading. I mean, this is the way, you know, we were taught to read Socrates, right? Socrates comes alive in his writings because we actually ask questions of him while we're engaged in it, right?
Yeah.
That's active reading. So I think that if the Bible's read that way, or the other, whatever else we're reading, then I think it is generating ideas and getting us to that thesis statement much more quickly and in a way that's exciting.
Okay.
Does that make sense? So I wouldn't make it a two different steps, I guess.
Sure. So we're not just reading for the sake of reading and enjoying those things, but with a particular purpose in mind, and always keeping that purpose in mind, to engage the text by, you know, asking questions of it and seeking to find those answers. It's not two separate things. You're not gathering a bunch of note cards and then trying to put them together afterward to see, you know, what can I say of this?
Right. You're not a 10th grader writing his first term paper just trying to find quotes just to have them. Right. Yeah. Right. No, we're actually, the word of God is living. Mm-hmm. And so God is speaking in this text. And right. So it's a somewhat combative process.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, combat, you know, probably depends on it. For me, it's combative. Probably depends on your personality. But I mean, it's, you know, you're engaged in an argument and in a discussion.
Yeah.
In this. Yeah. So the writer's block thing, I think one of the biggest problems we have is, so I always tell people, there's no such thing as writer's block. Writer's block is an excuse that we tell ourselves to make ourselves feel better about being lazy. Mm-hmm. There's no such thing as writer's block. You just do it. You know, there's no kind of, you know, it's time to weed the garden, but I can't do it because I have weeder's block. No, you just go do it. Right. You could make up excuse reasons you don't want to do it because it's boring, because you'd rather do something else. Well, this is what writing is. It's just work and you just have to do it. And you can do it. You can absolutely make yourself do it. And that's where, like you were talking about, that's why the calendar and the plan and so forth. So having an actual schedule, a strategy, a plan, a method, whatever you want to call it, that you're going to move forward, it prevents you from making up this fake excuse that you have writer's block. Mm-hmm. You don't. So it also, these things also create creativity.
Yeah.
If you actually have a structure and you have a plan, then you have the freedom for this. Again, like if real writers, right, people that make a living writing novels and other things, you know, they just have to do it. They just have to get up and do the work every day. But in forcing themselves to actually do it, instead of waiting for inspiration, their inspiration will come in the work. So you just have to write something. And often what you have to do is just write something that is, you know, maybe seems really shallow or obvious or benign, right, or cliched. But look, you did something. You know, you're doing something. And when you start doing it, then finally, that's when the stuff will come. Mm-hmm. And then finally, before we jump into, you know, kind of get into the details of what I do and what you do, is that, you know, we all give time in the ministry to the things that we actually value. Mm-hmm. And I really think that we teach the people what they're supposed to expect or want. So I do almost zero really classical counseling, but I probably do more confession and absolution than the average parish pastor. Mm-hmm. And that's because I emphasize it. And the people are looking to me here, right, to tell them, what does Christianity look like? How do I exercise my faith? What am I supposed to be doing? And I tell them they're supposed to be confessing their sins and coming to confession. Mm-hmm. And some of them do. I think in a lot of places, they're told that they need to come to the pastor for spiritual counsel and guidance, counseling, mm-hmm. and so they do. And it's the same thing if you tell the people that what you're supposed to be doing is spending all of your time administrating and in meetings and so forth, that's what you'll do. So you can make the time, you can absolutely make the time for this. That's why I think a calendar is so important, that if you just put it on there and you say, this is when I'm doing that. You know, if you had an elders meeting, you wouldn't blow it off and decide to do something else. If there's an elders meeting on the council, I mean, on the calendar, right? No one's ever done that. I mean, maybe not for long. Yeah, you know, you put on your sermon prep time in bites. Don't put a whole day because you won't do it that way. But you put it on your calendar and you honor it and you keep it. It's time that's needed. All the lay people know that and agree with it. So you have to give it the emphasis and the importance. And I think you're not too busy to spend whatever, 5 to 10 hours a week working on a sermon.
Right.
It is the kind of most essential activity of the ministry in some ways, and certainly the most central and visible, you know, work that we do. So mm-hmm. there you go.
No, that That makes a lot of sense, just in terms of placing the emphasis on it, and spending some time up front. And I think you're going to be talking about this. You know, I need time to chew on things, and so at least, you know, trying to be at least 2 weeks ahead in terms of just thinking, maybe you know, putting it on a shelf in the back of my mind, that I've had some thought about it already, so that it just has time to marinate.
Right.
I'm not, as much as I'd like to think I'm very quick on my feet, I'm not. Not in athletics or in oral sparring. I need practice and time to think about those things. So the more time that I allow for that, the better. And if you're planning that out, that helps. I guess that was my point.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And you'll give it the time that it needs, right? So that you're not just working on the thing for the immediate future, but a little bit out. And, you know, you're not unique in that you need time. We all do. There's been a lot of studies that have been done about how the subconscious mind works on problems. And we've all had this experience of, you know, so being in the shower and all of a sudden solving a problem, you know. You're trying to figure out why the lawnmower won't start, and you've, you know, it's got gas, it's got spark, it's got oxygen. Why isn't it firing? And, you know, you're in the shower, and then, you know, you realize that, I don't know, whatever, you know,
sure,
that the fuel's old or whatever. So you're, you know, and it was when you weren't actively thinking about it. In fact, it turns out that statistically, like, the best ideas tend to come from that subconscious mind. But for the subconscious mind to be able to work on something, it has to have material. Mm-hmm. It's not like you're in the shower and you come up with a problem to fix the lawnmower that you didn't know was broken. Mm-hmm. Or if you haven't spent any time doing some work on the lawnmower to, you know, see what the issues are. So that's part of that 2 weeks thing, is actually taking advantage of the way that our brains work and the way that God does inspire us.
Yeah.
So that, you know, it's there. It is a bit of a balancing act how far out you go.
Sure.
You don't want to go, you go too far, it's not going to be serious enough or critical enough that you're really working on it.
Sure.
And also you're going to be more prone to forgetting it. So yeah, I think the time thing is one of the, that's another, I think, mistake. Oh, so I was going to say, it's hilarious. So I spoke about this a little bit at Bugenhagen last year. And then, I can't remember, somewhere else. I've done this about 3 or 4 times now. And I am just astounded at the response. And I've had several pastors come up to me in their 60s and say, you know, I've never known how to write a sermon.
Mm.
And it's just been horrible. Yeah. And I just don't know what to do. And I've just, you know, and so, I mean, there are guys out there that are struggling with this. And if you're struggling with this, okay, stop, because here's a solution. You don't need to. There's a better way to go about this. And I don't know how, well, I mean, I don't know. I think the problem was, in my memory, maybe I remember it wrong, but what I remember from homiletics instruction was a ridiculous, impossible, idiotic schedule of what you would do every week that was mostly about how to do kind of deep exegesis in a very academic way.
Right.
You know, and I think that, you know, it wasn't really what I remember. And again, it could be just my own. I could have been taught the right thing and just not understood it. That's happened. But I don't think I was in this case. I don't think that I was taught homiletics from a point of view of how do you write something.
Mm-hmm.
I was taught homiletics because the homiletics professors were trying to actually teach me exegesis.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a pretty narrow idea of what that was.
Yeah.
And then, you know, so what I'm talking about is really, it's not theological exactly. This is just really, how do you get something written?
Yeah. Yeah. You're kind of focusing on the invention phase. Like if you're thinking about ancient rhetoric. You know, what are the tools for invention?
That's right.
You know, part of that is having material. It reminds me of the fact that, you know, they studied brain waves of chess players, they were good but novice chess players, and then, you know, the grandmasters. And the brain, the areas of the brain being used by both of those players are different. The novice is using the part of the brain that is in inventing things, you know, working things on the fly. The grandmaster is using his memory, his deep memory, because he's seen all these games. And so the more material that we have already built in, the better off we'll be setting ourselves up, not only for the subconscious, but actually to sit down and write something.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So do you want to head into your method? Like, let's break this down.
Sure.
How do you go about it?
Okay. So here's what I do. First of all, I use this Pomodoro productivity technique. There's a book about it. It's not worth buying. Here's everything there is to know about it. You work in 25-minute blocks, mm-hmm. and you monotask, right? Unitask, one thing only. So I set a timer. I use my phone. I just set a timer for 25 minutes. And then the idea is whatever I'm going to do, I don't just do this for sermon prep. I do this for everything. But like if the phone rings, I don't answer it. You know, I'm not allowed to change tasks. And that does a couple of things. First of all, it helps me focus. It removes kind of all the temptations to check my email or do anything else. And it also, I'm able to get more done because I stick with things. Mm-hmm. So I started doing this when I was working on an STM thesis. And the problem was I'd set, you know, I'm going to work on this for 2 hours this morning. And I just couldn't do it because it was so horrible, you know, so boring. Yeah. And there's other things to do and blah, blah, blah. And it didn't work. But what happens with the 25-minute thing is that I get started on it. And, you know, I'm bored and I want to quit, you know, and sermon writing. Sure, all the time. It's not always joyful every minute, right? But the problem is, so I'm like, oh, how much time has gone by? You know, and I'm like, oh my goodness, I've only been at this for 10 minutes. Well, there's only 15 minutes more, right? I can do anything for 15 minutes. I mean, that's not obviously completely true. But, you know, it's like, look, okay. And so I don't quit. If I would looked at the clock, I've been at it 10 minutes, I'm bored, I want to quit. And I've got, you know, an hour and 50 minutes to go. Yeah. Like, then I'm going to quit. But mm-hmm. if I look at the clock, I only got 15, I can keep going. And that enables me to get into the groove, right? Get the flow. And if you get into the, so then the timer goes off at the end of 15 minutes. Now I'm free and clear. I can stand up, go get a cup of coffee, go to the bathroom, check my email, whatever I need to do, you know, about a 5-minute break, and then boom, do another 25-minute session. But listen, if you're in the flow and the timer goes off, you just keep going.
Right.
Because, you know, that's like the magic stuff. And don't waste it. Don't stop just because the timer went off. But that's like bonus. And that happens actually a lot. Mm-hmm. But it wouldn't happen if I didn't get to that 20, 22 minute if I quit too early. So right. I really love this Pomodoro thing. I think multitasking, we know, is a lie. Nobody can multitask anyway. All we do is erode our attention and our focus. So we should be unitasking. And the like. The other thing I've gone to that's related to this is I do just about everything now with pen and paper. I have mm-hmm. a Bible on my desk and a legal pad, and that's what I have for sermon prep. I mean, you know, depending at the point I'm at in the process, but typically I have an English Bible and a legal pad and the Greek New Testament, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
And I write everything out. So while you're – okay, so now that's the general thing. So here's how I do it. More or less. And I'm only spending usually, you know, this is about a 5 or 6 hour process for me. That's mm-hmm. how long it takes me to write a sermon, typically. Sometimes mm-hmm. shorter, sometimes longer, sometimes, you know, the time I've got, right?
Right.
But I usually, this is pretty normal. I'd say I do this most of the time. This is about what it takes. And first of all, it's spread over 2 weeks. I like to be working 2 weeks out. So Monday of that first week, I'm looking at the text for, you know, 14 days or 13 days from then. So first thing on Monday morning, and I'm just going to do it in a 25-minute block. You know, so I'm going to translate just roughly. I'm going to translate, usually the gospel, right? I have a reader's edition of the New Testament that I love. I don't have a lexicon. I don't need one because it's right there. I can read the Greek New Testament with that thing good enough. Mm-hmm. And if I don't know what a word means, I can't figure it out, I just keep going. I mean, I'm not going to publish this. I'm just trying to read it and think about it. And I have the English Bible there with me too, to be looking at the same time. Mm-hmm. So, and while I'm doing that, you know, as we said, that kind of active reading, but I take notes. So I also use those notes, by the way, to free my memory if I remember something that I need to do. Like I'm like, oh shoot, so-and-so wasn't in church yesterday. I need to call him. Mm-hmm. So I write that down so that I don't have to remember it and think about it when I'm trying to do this other thing. So that's important too. Anything that comes up that pops into your brain, or sometimes, you know, just like the shower thing, you get a great idea about some other problem you're working on. Hey, who am I going to get to? I need a new person to run the youth group, you know, and I can't think of it. And then while I'm doing this, I think of it. Well, I don't want to go off a rabbit trail on that. So I write that down. Mm-hmm. And that way I haven't ignored it, but I'm going to do it later. Yeah. And that helps me stay on task also. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely.
So that's kind of block one. And then that same day, you know, in another 25-minute block, I'm going to do the other stuff. I'm going to read the context of the pericope. I'm going to read, you know, the parallels if there is. I'm going to read the Old Testament and the New Testament. And all the time I'm kind of thinking about fivefold use. And now I also always think about allegory in a disciplined way that I never used to. It used to be allegories just appeared. Now I go hunting for them, which okay. is different for me. But it's not much different than the first session. I might, at that point, I might pull out a lexicon or Wallace's, you know, Beyond the Basics, his intermediate grammar, mm-hmm. or something like that.
Now, when you say you go hunting for allegory, what does that mean?
Well, now, just like I'll sort of deliberately say, I mean, I always basically say, what doctrines does this teach? What doctrines are included in this? Mm-hmm. You know, even if it's not a sedes of that doctrine, you know, what's implied or suggested? And in a similar way, I just say, what's the theological meaning of this? You know, what's going on here that's beyond the surface? And is there a connection with vocabulary, you know, or with images, or is there a peculiar way? And the other thing with that is to look and to see if it's actually poetic. I was really surprised. Where was that? Oh, in the a few weeks ago in Lent, we had the Bartimaeus account. Oh, before that, you have the Jesus gives the passion prediction, right. And then Luke says they did not understand these things. They did not know them, and they did not understand, and they did not. I can't remember. Or it was hidden from them.
Yeah.
So it's like this redundant threefold phrase. And I'm like, oh my gosh, that's a poem. I mean, it's not really a poem, but it's a poetic, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm looking kind of actively. Are there things like this in the text that are conveying something in a poetic way or an allegorical way, mm-hmm. that could be missed if we're not looking for them?
Yeah. Yeah. So during my initial, like the questions that I'm asking, I'm always asking things like, so define this thing, you know, maybe it's, you know, the water jars, what are those water jars? Or who is this person? Where do they pop up elsewhere? What is the relationship between, and this gets into context, but the relationship to this part, to what's come before and what's coming after, or what do we see in the whole of Scripture and its relationship there? Yeah. And what are the immediate circumstances? Where are they? What does it mean that he's in Galilee versus Jerusalem,
yeah.
or those sorts of things? And then I'm just looking for comparisons. What is this like, and how is this different? How is it different maybe from the other accounts? What mm-hmm. you know, what part sticks out in this particular account, or what sticks out in the other ones that isn't here that needs to actually be brought in, like when you're looking at Transfiguration and you've got to bring Luke's what they're talking about, and things like that. So how is it similar and how is it different? And those are the five common topics of of invention in ancient rhetoric that you compare, define, you find the relationship and the circumstances, and then eventually, like, by what authority? So you can even ask of the things. So the gospel reading for this morning in Matins was the, you know, the traditions of men versus God's word. By whose authority are people doing things? And that asking these questions always translates pretty well to being able to put ourselves in those spots.
Yes. Yeah. That's always right. We do, even if we don't use the exact language, there is always the sort of, so what?
Yeah.
Right. What does this matter to me or to the hearer? Mm-hmm. I should have said earlier, I did not always do this way. In fact, when I was early in the ministry, I was an absolute mess, a total lunatic. I really suffered from this fake writer's block thing, and I would spend, man, in those days, I mean, I would spend 20, 25 hours easy on a sermon and then go home on Saturday night and not have a sermon written and go to bed, set the alarm clock. I did this every week. I mean, almost every week. Set the alarm clock for 3 o'clock in the morning. Get up, go over to the church, and write a sermon in a flurry of activity and stress. Mm-hmm. And usually, you know, in the kind of hour and a half before church, most of it would finally go. Mm-hmm. It was terrible, and it wasn't healthy. Jackie didn't approve. Yeah, I mean, I should, but I didn't know what to do. I felt like I was, and I didn't. I was surprised. I said I've been talking about this in a few places, and I was surprised to find out. I thought I was just a total lunatic, which I guess I was, but I thought it was unique. But it turns out lots of guys have had that same experience. Mm-hmm. And because they don't, so what happened was for me, you know, I was still doing that when I got to Fort Wayne. And I think that was, I listened to a book by Stephen King on writing, which I really love. It's really mm-hmm. a good book. And that was where I realized that, you know, why am I doing this? And it was because I needed the pressure, right? I mm-hmm. needed the pressure and the stress of the SERP to actually be able to actually do the work. And then realized I could just make myself do that.
Right. Right.
I did. I mean, it sounds so obvious, but it was like, look, you can just make your own deadline. Mm-hmm.
So,
you know, you just make it.
Yeah. So when you're by Monday of this, do you want a few things, like if someone asked me to preach on this right now, are you looking for to be able to say, here's the doctrine, and then here's what we're trying to refute with regard to this doctrine? Here's the false understandings that go along with it. Here is the training in righteousness, and here are the rebukes that go along with that. And then this is the comfort that this text brings. So that if someone came up to you, you could say, well, this text teaches us about this, and we shouldn't misunderstand how some have misunderstood this. And this trains us in righteousness in this way, but we should be careful. We should hear God's rebuke that we don't run amiss in going this way or that way. And finally, here's the comfort. That is that what you're kind of looking for, to be able to at least summarize? I don't want to say outline, but have a general summary that you could summarize the text if someone said, what's this about? And you could say, bam, 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 bam.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I don't know that we need to have every use of the fivefold use in every text, but absolutely. I mean, any of us ought to, after you've been in the ministry for a while, for sure. You mm-hmm. know, I could walk in the pole. I mean, I could preach a sermon on anything in the Bible with zero prep. Mm-hmm. I mean, I could read the passage, and as I'm reading it, figure out a sermon.
Right.
You know, and then do it and deliver it. And, you know, and if something's really gone wrong, you might have to do that.
Right.
But I would say that, like, And I would, most of the time, I think at this point, my reading's not that deep usually. I am just like, whatever, you know, Jesus is baptized in the Jordan River. Okay. This is about baptism, you know, right. Good. I mean, it's not false and it's, but you know, I'm not probably at this point seeing that much detail.
Gotcha.
Or, right. And one of the things I'm going to do, which I think almost all of us probably do, is I'm going to be you know, using these texts, like with the shut-ins, to preach sermons that I haven't prepared, that I'm just making up on the spot. And, you know, they're fine, but they're not, you know, great sermons.
Right.
And I think, you know, that kind of immediate answer to the sort of fivefold use is important because it gives us a foundation and a base, but that's not usually, those first answers aren't usually where the real fruit is. Sometimes, you know, it's enough. You know what? I just need to preach a sermon on baptism. Okay, good for you. That's great. But those aren't usually the most textual.
Okay.
You know, they're kind of like, here's a, this is about baptism. Well, here's a bunch of other stuff you should know about baptism. You know, that's fair. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. I guess I'm just thinking like, you know, one text could give us a doctrine to preach on, but also a training in righteousness.
And yeah.
And then along with that, also here's the comfort that this particular text brings. And should we actually be looking to fill all those spots?
Yes, I think we should. Okay. And so, and there are a lot of texts that can fill all five.
Right.
You know, and but sometimes I think, you know, sometimes we're going to be kind of wed. I mean, it's not that it's not there, but let's say, you know, seek ye first the kingdom of God, right? You know, I mean, if you start, you're going to end up just kind of pigeonholing some things to try to get it out there. Like, what's the comfort that that, you know, the comfort that that brings, that there is a kingdom of God, that it's actually seekable? I mean, I suppose, but I mean, mostly I think, you know, seek first the kingdom of God is a, right, is a doctrine and a training in righteousness more than, you know, I don't know. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Sometimes we're, So, but there are texts for sure, especially if you do more than one sentence. There are lots of texts that I think have all five legitimately, but you know, there's probably going to be an, there's probably going to be an emphasis within the text itself upon two or three of them.
Yeah.
Okay. I've not tried to figure that out. You know, I'm just, that's my sense of it. Sure. I haven't ever.
So you're, on Monday, you've translated in 30 minutes, and then you've looked at all the parallels, looking for allegory, looking for fivefold use. So by Monday, that's an hour. And the next thing is my favorite thing that you have on your list.
That's right. I, this is what I do now. I talk to you every week for an hour about it. And it's great. It's super helpful to me. I mean, I know that's why not everybody can, I don't know, everybody should call you for a week and talk.
Or maybe find someone they can talk to for an hour.
Right. So, and I don't know, you know, that it, it is a hard thing to replicate, but I think it is an important thing to note how useful it is because, you know, you're pushing back on stuff I'm saying and, you know, and bringing in other things. And, you know, it's forcing me to think about what I said. It's helping me see things I didn't see. And, you know, there's a camaraderie and a joy in that, you know, those are fun conversations. I mean, I'm glad that there are some people that listen to them. You know, and that it's useful to some people. Great. I'm very glad about that. But it's useful enough to me that in some sense, I don't even need anybody to listen to us.
Yeah.
It's just part now of it's very helpful to me. Yeah. And we're doing them about 2 weeks in advance usually. So, and then I said the next thing I'm, and then, so that's about all I'm going to do for the 2 weeks out. That's enough to really get the juices flowing and me thinking about these texts. Now I need to focus on the sermon this Sunday, which I started, you know, 10 days ago.
Yeah.
So I've had all that time. I've got my notes, the notes I use, those notes that I took are the notes that I use to talk to you. So I've got those. Sometimes I take notes during our talks. Sometimes I just doodle. But, you know, I've got that. And now I'm going to, on like Wednesday, say, of the week, you know, where the Sundays come in just a few days, now I'm going to really start using this text to try to craft a sermon. I'm going to use it with shut-ins and others that week. And now I'm going to start also, again, in these 25-minute blocks, I'm going to spend probably one whole block just looking at the commentaries, you know, or well, by commentaries, you know, I'm going to, I almost always try to consult the blue Concordia commentaries. And, you know, I'm not reading every word of the commentary on it and all the textual notes, but I like to at least look at it and have some sense of what, you know, is said there in those places. I like to try to find, you know, sermons as well. So that's going to be like another 25-minute thing. I'm going to at least look at some sermons. Or if not sermons, then this would probably be what I would read, Parsh or Lindemann. You know, again, kind of sermonic. Those are kind of sermonic commentaries. But to try to have some sense on what other people have said about this and how they've applied it.
Now, so I find that I kind of go in like year chunks. Like I'll have the year of Gerhard that I'm just just looking at Gerhard's sermons just to see. And then I'll have the year of Luther, and then I'll have the year of Lindemann. And even with commentaries, like I'll spend, you know, 1 year just making sure every week I look, I might pick other things up, but that I'll look at Kretzmann's popular commentary. I mean, it's short, it has, but sometimes the summaries are just good enough of not just a pericope, but of an entire chapter that it kind of puts things into perspective to say, huh, I never put it together that way. I must be missing something, or I totally disagree and I'll go back, but that's pretty rare. But it forces me back to look at the text and the context and just in a different way.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. I've never been that big a fan of Kretzmann because it just, you know, it's so kind of simple. I mean, not that I hate it, but it just doesn't, you know, but the summaries, that's good.
He answers the questions that all my laymen want to know, like all the stuff that I would never prepare for. And so it helps me to prepare, like, this is what they are going to be asking about. And it's usually, you know, it's maybe more obscure. It's less theological, more historical, you know, those sorts of things.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's really all the prep I do. And then I take Fridays off. So I come in on Saturday morning and usually in one 25-minute session, I write the sermon.
Okay.
I write a thesis statement at the top of the page, it's hard to believe, but I preach from notes now. I switched about 2 years ago, because I was reading all of this rhetorical stuff, and the problem is you can't walk into the Roman Senate with a manuscript.
Right.
I mean, memory is one of the canons, and you got to have the thing. So. I don't memorize them. I write pretty full outlines, but I do handwrite them and then try to preach them. Usually I just write it. On Saturday, I just write one. And then I've got one. I've got a sermon. I've got an outline, a pretty full outline with a thesis statement and how this is going to go. And then on Sunday morning, I come in, not at 3 o'clock in the morning, but I get here by 6:30, church is at 8:00. So I have pretty much a whole hour with nobody bugging me. Mm-hmm. And during that time, I'll grab those notes. I'll go in the pulpit. I'll try to preach it. And then I do quite a bit of editing on Sunday morning. And sometimes we'll rewrite it. I'll come back into my office or do it right. And with that same legal pad, and I'll do a whole new outline. I mean, not usually a whole new outline, but a kind of tweaking of the thing. And I'll do that two or three times usually until it feels right.
Yeah. I have found outlining, I never used to like it, but I like it more and more. To be able to, I mean, even for Bible class, just to keep on task and to remind me of where I'm going and you know, where this whole thing is heading. So it gives me the big picture, but also the zeroed in detail that we're going to be working on that day. I think we need to reacquaint ourselves with the skill of outlining and outlining well.
Yeah. I think you're absolutely right. And I mean, again, we have this lack of training or experience with writing. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of people, you know, in English 101, they learn about outlines, but they never do them. They just launch right into the paper. They just start writing the paper without an outline. And that's why they stink, because there's no kind of really structure or logical flow to the thing. And, you know, it's not impossible to do that and to do it well, but you need to have at least an outline in your head. And you need to think, I mean, again, this is part of the arrangement. You need to think about how the material is presented in a way that it's actually underscoring and supporting and demonstrating the thesis. Mm-hmm. You know, it has to be coherent. This is an activity of communication. Mm-hmm. I think the same, you know, and I do the same thing for Bible class as well. You know, look, when I go down to teach a Sunday morning Bible class, I have points that I want to make. I feel like sometimes when I visit places, I not very often, but I've been in Bible classes where it seems like the guy's just up there just talking. Mm-hmm. And he's just talking and he enjoys hearing himself. And he just thinks we all should just sit and listen to him. I mean, he's not teaching. Mm-hmm. Because he's not actually intentional. He didn't come with a plan.
Right.
And I'm not impressed. I think that I often have heard, you know, guys say, you know, they love teaching Bible class and they think they're good at it. But my experience is that, you know, it's a skill also that needs to be honed and need to be deliberate about it. There is something to some pedagogy, and I'm not sure we're as good at Bible class as we think we are.
Right.
So anyway.
Well, again, we can certainly get better. And that's, I mean, again, outlining.
Yeah. All the outline is the plan.
Yes.
I mean, it's just you have a plan, and the plan has a purpose, right? I want that, and that's what the thesis statement is. I want them to know this.
Right.
And, you know, and how am I going to get them to know this? That's the outline, by telling them this and then this, you know.
Yeah.
And all that fivefold, or, you know, all of that rhetorical stuff, I'm going to anticipate their arguments, or I'm going to, you know, blah, 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 mm-hmm. right? That's important.
Yes.
And I think that it does make a difference in that people actually can learn things in sermons and actually, you know, be edified by them. I don't think that the sermon is the same thing as the absolution. And that's another kind of, you know, that's some of this is sort of a response to that. For a long time, there were people in the Missouri Synod that just couldn't tell the difference between an absolution and a sermon.
Right.
And, you know, a sermon they provide the same thing, but in a different way, just like Holy Communion's not the same thing as the absolution.
Right.
So the sermon is supposed to be explication of a text for Christians. It's also, a sermon's also not the same thing as evangelism.
Right.
Because like evangelism is a matter of systematics, right? Where you're picking the texts that prove your point and, you know, you're trying, but instead in sermons, you're given the text.
Right.
And then you have to teach it. You have to teach that text to the people.
Mm-hmm. Now, have you ever, you know, looked at, say, a season and tried, not putting together a series, but look to make an overarching point throughout an entire season that kind of builds up from the text already given? Do you ever plan like that?
Well, no, I should. That sometimes just happens. It kind of seems to we were talking the other day and you picked up on something I've been doing this Lent. Right now it's the Tuesday of or Wednesday of Reminiscere. And I've been making a big deal about a man shall proceed from every word man shall live by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. And that started basically on Invocabit and then somehow came in on, you know, the next two Sundays. And so, I mean, sometimes it just seems to happen, but it would be nice if it was actually planned.
Yeah. Well, you can't do everything, right?
No, you can't. And, you know, I think also we all have our kind of idiosyncrasies, the things that we like. Some guys, like you brought up, and I think it can be very useful, like geography is a big deal to some guys. Where is Jesus? I don't pay that much attention to that. I like it when other people do, but it just kind of isn't, do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, in our day, I am always trying to demonstrate in certain ways, like these are specific places and this isn't just a story, right?
I think that's good.
Yeah. And I think particularly for, you know, we don't have a Lutheran school attached, and so most of our kids end up, a small amount are homeschooled. Some go to a kind of non-denominational Christian school, but most of them are in the public school. And so, you know, the parents are good, solid parents. They're trying to do the best by them as they can in those circumstances. But, you know, offering those refutations to, you know, these are just stories or these are just made up. I always have that kind of in the back of my mind.
I think that's good. And I think it's absolutely right. This is history. Carl Fabricius is really good at knowing what other things happened at those places, which sort of brings in the allegorical side of things. So
I know,
like, you know,
I just talked to him about like looking at rocks in the Pentateuch. And he's like, I just finally had a chance to study this and I've been meaning to do this for a long time. So we were like talking for an hour and 15 minutes on all the times that the different rock names for rock in the Old Testament come up and what they're related to. And of course, he's quizzing me all along the way, like, and do you know where this pops up? I'm like, oh, geez, Carl.
No, right. Well, I mean, some of it's, I was meaning more like, you know, well, what else happened to Jericho? Well, okay, Jericho, you know, we've heard of that before, mm-hmm. Bethlehem, but then he'll pull up something like Susa, you know, and you're like, what? I don't know. Well, that's where the fourth beast came and blah, 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 you know, or whatever it is.
I know, he's so great.
And then, you know, that's where Mordecai was. Oh, really? Okay. No, he is great. And I think that's I appreciate that. It's just, and I haven't tried to develop it, but it's just something that doesn't feel like it comes to me as naturally
sure.
as some other things.
I think we've been ruined by you know, historical criticism and higher criticism that it's still it's not only ruined us just in terms of, you know, what we can trust or what we feel we can trust, but even, I mean, it drives all of the way we do things.
We're always trying to prove it's real.
And not only that, but like we end up doing well, this is according to Luke and that's according to John.
Right.
I mean, that is not something that Augustine, Ambrose, or really even the reformers were doing. They were harmonizing. They were always bringing these things in.
Always. They believe the Holy Spirit wrote it.
Right.
And but if you're trying to give a paper at the Society for Biblical Literature, you know, No, that's right. You know, another thing in terms of this preaching thing is, I said we should love it and we should. And if some of our listeners don't love it, you need to cultivate that. And, you know, again, like listen to somebody like Carl Fabricius, and you can just hear his love and his joy in this as it should be. And I think you can find that. You can cultivate it. But the other thing that goes along with that to get better at preaching, you know, is to actually force yourself to do it, to do a lot of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to write a blog post for the Gottesdienst thing before Lent, and I didn't get around to it, about the goodness of having Holy Communion every day in Lent and having to preach every single day. And it's a little bit of a burden. You know, it requires effort and it takes some time. You can't put 5 or 6 hours into each of those sermons. You got to knock it out an hour. But you do learn a lot doing that. And those are probably not the best sermons, admittedly. But you're also talking to a very distinct group of people from within your membership that are quite pious, and you can take a few risks, right? You're not going to ruin them by, you know, not properly distinguishing between law and gospel one time.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that we don't want to always do that, but, you know, you can go in less prepared. You can talk a little more from the cuff. You can sort of take the risk because these people that come to a, you know, divine service on Tuesday morning at 7 o'clock, you know, are hardcore and they're already well kept. So that's a really great discipline mm-hmm. to have to preach every day and to not just say the same thing every day.
Mm-hmm. Well, don't you have matins every day anyway?
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Do it that way then. Yeah. I do it at that too, but I was thinking for like, you know, some of our listeners that don't do that every day or that don't have people coming to those matins, mm-hmm. how do they, because this discipline of having to preach all the time, I just think it's really good for us. And I think I'm thankful for it that I've had to learn a lot.
Yeah. Well, Yeah, I think it's really helpful to learn how to do that with short amount of prep because, I really think we should start thinking about almost every interaction with our people as an opportunity to preach.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Like, yes. So I prep for my elders' meetings differently now than I did when I first. It was all kind of business, agenda. I still do all that. But now I'm thinking, all right, so I have an opportunity in our devotion to have 15 minutes of their attention. What is it that I need to preach on? And then I just go hunting. And I do the same thing for the Board of Ed and for the Board of Missions, the trustees. I just set out to try to do that. And always holding before them, you know, why we exist, what we're here for. And this is all of, we're given all of these opportunities to preach and teach. And we view them as like, actually, obstacles to preaching and teaching, but these are the these are the places to do it.
Yeah, I agree. No, I think that's I like that. I think that's right. I think also there's there is this kind of need to just be engaged in spiritual conversations all the time mm-hmm. as a fulfillment of you know Deuteronomy 6. And to be unashamed of it. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
No, that's true. Like, always be ready in season and out of season.
Right, and to be actually talking about things that matter, mm-hmm. you know, instead of the business items. And I mean, obviously there's a place for those things too. But I think that is helpful to remember.
Yeah. So, okay. Any final thoughts? Any kind of wrap up in terms of? One last,
well,
if you do anything, do this.
Yeah, I mean, if you do anything, I think schedule your times to work on this and schedule it in small bites, but many of them. Mm-hmm. But you need to just come at it. You know, that the book I mentioned by Stephen King, I would recommend On Writing, it's called. I'm not a Stephen King fan. I'm not a fan of his fiction, but that's a really good book on writing.
Yeah.
And the Pomodoro technique, I don't know, those kinds of things. But you don't have to, again, take this exact thing, but.
Well, I think your like small chunks is a really helpful thing, not just using the Pomodoro method. But I mean, I think David Allen talks about this in Getting Things Done, where it's like we tend to think of the final part of the task, like, so write a sermon. And we think of that and it's like, so we put that on our list, but that's so huge. There's
right.
so much involved. So what's the actual first step of writing the sermon? Oh, okay. Well, I need to read the text. I need to, so you break things up so that you actually have things to cross off instead of just having this one big thing that you're just like, well, I don't have time to write a sermon right now. And so you push it off. You do have time to read the text. You do have time to do a translation. You do have time to ask some questions of it. And by breaking it up, like you got to do the very next step. What's the next step in order to do that final thing? This happens to me, like even with small things like I need an oil change in my car and I'll just put oil change on my list. And I'm like, you know, that's not the next step. The next step is call for an appointment. If I just put oil change, it's like, I don't have time to do an oil change. But I do have time to make a phone call.
There you go. Yeah, that's good. I like that. I read that book a long time ago. I'd forgotten that part of it.
Yeah. I think that was the most helpful part of his, his thing, is breaking down those big tasks.
Good. Well, so, thanks.
All right. Well, thanks for your insight. I think this is super, super helpful. And for those of you who have your own protocols already sorted, you know, if you have something, if you think we might benefit from hearing what you do, you know, when this comes out, put it in the comments. We'd love to hear it.
Well, I mean, if they can put it in the comments before it comes out, that'd be even better.
Did I say before?
No, you said when it comes out, put it in there. Never mind.
All right. Thanks
All
for
right,
your time.
Thank you. Thanks.